All right. Now, I think we've probably got about everyone in the whole country who's interested in this topic in this room together, and there's probably no one else outside this room who's interested in at least half of this. There's a few more people who may be interested in the second half of what I'm going to talk about. So what I want to talk about two things today. Now, none of this should be of any great news to anyone here, but I thought it's worthwhile explaining how we see the whole thing working, provide a little bit more context to what you might have already learnt. So the first part of what I want to talk about is the upcoming changes to the payments system, which are coming in November. I sent a number of you in this room a letter about this a couple of months ago now, and about the changes we're making there and how we expect that to operate. So hopefully everyone can get some understanding around that. And the second thing I want to talk about, which is in some part, some sense related, is about the committed liquidity facility, which is obviously not coming in until the beginning of 2015, but is very much having an effect on, the implications of that are basically affecting what people are doing today. So I want to explain a bit about how that's going to work and also provide a little more background on the fee and also the pricing about how we've come up with that and how we expect that to work. So they're the two things I want to try and get across today. Most of the work's actually been done by Matt rather than me. And so if there's any particularly esoteric questions, I'll hand them to him or to Pete Gallagher, particularly on the payment side. But I hope most of it is fairly self-evident, but certainly happy to take questions. And it's probably useful to do it in this forum so that because there's probably going to be a few people who are interested in the answers. So these two changes will be introduced at different points during the next 18 months, and they're going to have significant implications for the size of the Reserve Bank's balance sheet and also in the way, some sense, in the way we provide liquidity to financial institutions. But in another sense, it's actually doing exactly what we've been doing for the past few decades, but just changing a few things around the edges. So the primary purpose, just to step back a second, the primary purpose of the Reserve Bank's operating framework is to implement the monetary policy decisions of the Reserve Bank Board. So as you all know, the Board states its policy stance in terms of a target for the cash rate. So to be precise, that's the rate on overnight unsecured loans between ADIs, basically between people in this room. So while the Board has been announcing targets for the cash rate since 1990, the bank's operating framework has continued to evolve over that time, although the underlying principles haven't changed. And what we're talking about going forward, those underlying principles are still exactly the same. To a large extent, these modifications have been prompted by the need to accommodate several changes within markets, such as the end of the arrangements for authorised money market dealers in the mid-1990s, and then subsequently the reduced supply of government bonds over the following decade. So in responding to these developments, the bank has been guided by the need for its operating framework to continue to enable the bank to meet the board's cash rate target and also to facilitate the most effective transmission of those policy decisions to the prices of financial assets more broadly and, of course, ultimately to the real economy. So with that in mind, during the financial crisis, when different segments of financial markets became impaired to varying degrees, the bank modified several aspects of its operating framework. Now, some of those changes were only temporary and were discontinued after markets stabilised, such as offering term deposits or the US dollar swap line. Other changes have been permanent, such as the broadening the range of securities that are eligible for market operations. At the same time, the bank's operating framework has also needed to adapt to changes in the payment system, such as the shift to RTGS in the late 1990s, and also the settlement of the Aussie dollar leg of foreign currency transactions via CLS a few years later. So going forward, further innovations to the payment system, as well as the introduction of the Basel III liquidity reforms, are requiring more changes to be made. So before describing those changes, I'm just going to step back and look at what the core features are of the way we operate in the market and the way we provide liquidity. And I'm sure some of this is all very familiar to you, but I think it's worthwhile doing in terms of setting the stage for what we're going to do, what we're proposing to do later. And we're not what we're proposing, we are going to do it. So essentially, the bank seeks to control the supply of settlement funds that ADIs use to meet their payment obligations, so the rate at which ADIs borrow and lend these funds to each other is equal to the cash rate target. To create the incentive for ES account holders to participate in the cash market, the bank pays account holders 25 points below the cash rate target on their end-of-day balances, and then on the other side, a penalty rate of 25 basis points above cash if an ADI needs to borrow overnight from us to ensure its ES balance remains positive. So the binding constraint, as you all know, is that your ES balance has to remain positive. Together, those rates comprise the 50 basis point interest rate corridor that the bank uses to guide the cash rate to the board's target. So as payments to and from the Reserve Bank or its clients, which is mostly the government, are constantly changing the supply of ES funds, each day, as you know, we transact in the market to maintain the appropriate supply of funds. These transactions are almost always repos. That is, the bank's counterparty agrees to repo the security it has sold to the bank at some future date. So that framework has been successful in achieving its objectives. The interbank cash market is quite active. Now, I'm sure most of you are aware, but now we've started publishing the data on the cash market up there on the website every day, including the turnover. So we publish the rate that the market trades at, which is almost invariably the target. We also put the high and the low, which is almost always invariably the target as well. And then we're also publishing the amount of volume which is actually going through the market. So that volume is around at the moment is around $5 billion a day. So that's the overnight lending in the market, which is the volume which actually determines how we calculate. You know, it's the rate at which that volume turns over, which is how we actually calculate the cash rate. And as I said, as it turns out, the cash rate consistently trades at the board's target. In the past few years, we've had one or two days where it's deviated by a basis point, but that's about it. Changes in the cash rate pass through rapidly to the, as you all know, to the overall rate structure within the domestic markets. So with that as background, I'll now turn to the changes to the payment system and explain why they're likely, what they're likely to mean for the demand for ES balances. So at the moment, the demand for ES balances is generally low, as banks or ADIs seek to minimise their balances, subject to the constraint and the very much binding constraint that they have to be positive. So although ES funds are a risk-free investment, which I know some of you have trouble convincing your home regulators that we are a risk-free investment, but nevertheless, we certainly regard ourselves as a risk-free investment, the 25 basis point spread to the cash rate is usually wide enough to discourage ADIs from using them, so the ES balances, or us, effectively, as a store of liquidity. During periods of financial turmoil, that obviously changes. So between 2007 and 2009, the amount of ES funds rose as ADIs became increasingly risk-averse and sought to hold larger precautionary balances with us. Now, we accommodated that increase in demand for balance for ES balances by increasing the supply, so that at the peak, sometime around December 2008, the peak of ES balances was about $18 billion. But at the moment, and subsequently, and for most of the recent history, ES balances at the end of each day have usually been only around $1 billion. So a very small component of our balance sheet and of obviously of your liquid assets. So as payments arrangements evolve in the coming years, the demand for ES funds, we think, will rise significantly. So as you all know, the Payment System Board last year established a number of strategic objectives for the payment system, including improving the process for settling electronic DE payments. So the direct entry system is used very widely, such as for salary payments, Centrelink, pay anyone internet transfers, as long as your bank's internet site is actually working, and for many dividend payments. While most individual direct credit and direct debit transfers are quite low in value, the total value of such payments averages more than $40 billion a day. So that's... At present, like most low-value payments, direct entry payments are not settled on the same day that the details of the transactions are exchanged between financial institutions. So DE payments are settled in one batch at 9 a.m. on the following business day. From November this year, DE payments will be able to be settled for same-day value, albeit still in batches. While this should be version of this speech on the website, I've got a nice, very simple graph of the whole payments day, which shows you when all the batches are going to be. While this should be of great benefit to financial institutions and more particularly their customers, some of these settlements will be taking place outside of normal banking hours. Now, to some extent, one solution to this whole problem would have been that we could have declared that normal banking hours were 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In interest of our welfare and also your welfare, we decided not to go down that route. So at the time, we're still going to have a finish to the cash market, basically the same as it is currently. So at the time the interbank cash market closes at the end of the day, under this new system, ADIs will not know the size of these payments or receipts that they will now need to be settling later in the evening. So there's going to be batches coming through after the end of the cash day, and you're not going to know the likely size of these. And potentially they could be quite large. So to be assured of having sufficient funds with which to meet payments through the evening, so after the cash market's closed, ADIs directly involved in the DE exchanges will each need to retain higher balances in their ES accounts. And so from November, we expect ES balances to increase from their current level of $1 billion to be between $20 and $30 billion on an ongoing basis. So every day, ES balances are going to be somewhere between $20 and $30 billion. So this is designed to ensure that payments made after the close of the day don't result in ADIs facing negative balances and hence being unable to make the payments. So we want those payments to go through. We have the constraint that ES balances can't be negative. So we're going to have people hold higher ES balances. So the way we've calculated that size, and I think I detailed this in the letter that I sent you, is we've examined the largest payment obligations that have arisen from those later batches in recent times. So we've taken that number and then provided a bit of a buffer above that. So we're fairly confident that that number is going to be sufficient to meet whatever payment is likely to come through outside normal hours. That said, we'll review that size regularly and see, and particularly as the payments patterns may actually evolve as we move to this new system. So we will keep that under review and adjust that balance up or down as necessary. So, as I said, our balance sheet's going to go up by $20 or $30 billion. We'll manage that expansion in our balance sheet through our existing liquidity facility for ES account holders. So unlike open market operations, which we do by an auction every day, repos via the bank's liquidity facility are made available to ES account holders on pre-specified terms. Now, at the present, ES account holders usually only access this facility for intraday funding. So repos used for this purpose for intraday funding, as you all know, carry no interest charge. So during the course of a normal day, the pool of ES balances and therefore the size of our balance sheet actually tends to expand by around $10 to $15 billion. So our balance sheet generally goes up $10 or $15 during the day as these intraday repos are taken out, and at the end of the day it goes back down to where it was before. So you guys take out the intraday repos to give yourselves the capacity to make payments before the settlement of incoming funds. Basically, if we didn't have that, then everything would just be stuck until late in the day, when then suddenly everything would try and settle all at once. By the end of each day, these repos are unwound. On the very rare occasion that such repos are carried over to the next day, a penalty interest rate, which is the top of the corridor, 25 basis points above the cash rate target, applies. From November, the bank will allow ES account holders to access a predetermined amount of funds through that liquidity facility on an open basis. So open repos are those contracted with an agreed maturity date. The interest rate on these open repos will be set at the cash rate target. At the same time, we'll still keep charging. We're going to change the way that interest on ES balances is calculated. So all your ES balances are going to go up. We're going to change the way that the interest is actually is calculated. To the extent that account holders retain matching funds against their open repo position, these ES balances will earn the cash rate rather than 25 points below the cash rate. So you're going to have amount of funds which matches your open repo, you'll get charged the cash rate on that at the same time as you're getting paid the cash rate on that, so no net flow of income. Your ES balances above and beyond that will still have the same remuneration as they do currently. So these changes will increase the size of our balance sheet. It's going to go up by $20 or $30 billion, but we're not going to change the net income that the bank earns, or looking at it from your side, not going to change the net income that you're paying us or receiving from us. In net terms, then, there need be no cost to holding an open repo position. However, as is the case currently, surplus ES funds, that is funds held in excess of an open repo position, will earn a rate 25 basis points below the cash rate target. Similarly, any shortfall in funds below the account holder's open repo position will incur a 25 basis point penalty. So let me make that clear, particularly on that last one. Even though you'll have what looks like a positive ES balance, you can still be charged 25 points below if that ES balance is less than the size of your open repo position. An allowance, that said, an allowance will be made for variations in ES balances arising from DE payments that settle during the evening. So we think that this arrangement will not only provide the means for ADIs to hold sufficient liquidity to complete the payments outside the normal hours, it will still preserve the incentive for ADIs to participate in the cash market while it is opening, just as they, as everyone does today. So lending surplus balances to, and borrowing against a shortfall. And given that, we expect that the surplus or the excess supply of ES balances to be much as it is now, so around $1 billion, above the sum of the outstanding positions in open repos. So we don't think that these operational changes will alter the way in which we implement monetary policy. We think the operation of the cash market will be insulated from the structural increase in ES balances. So effectively, what you can think of is that the ES balance has been sort of grossed up, or our balance sheet's been grossed up, but the cash market is still sitting on the top of that and will be basically the same size as it is today. We also think this framework leaves us well placed to accommodate further innovations in the payment system in the coming years, such as the planned shift to 24/7 settlement for retail payments. Now, one consequence of the new arrangement is that it will largely remove the need for an ES account holder to contract open intraday repos with us. For this reason, the bank will allow all the ADIs that operate ES accounts to contract open repos, not just those participating in DE exchanges. So what that means is that effectively we don't think there'll be much need for intraday repos going forward. Despite the operational changes the bank is making, we nevertheless recognise that shifting a large quantity of payments activity to same-day settlement will complicate the task for liquidity managers. So it's always difficult to forecast customers' payments activities. And that's not only true for you guys, it's also true for us. So the size of our daily market operations each morning are largely based on a forecast of that day's cash flows across the government's accounts with us. Settling DE payments for same-day value will make it more difficult to forecast flows, particularly tax receipts. So it may be the case that the Reserve Bank will need to conduct operations in the market late in the day to address any unexpected payment flows and ensure the right amount of settlement funds are in the banking system to allow the cash market to function appropriately. So we do that today, but generally only two or three times a year. So when we resort to a second round of dealing to address the fact that the liquidity flows during the day weren't what we expected they were at the beginning of the day, we do come back into the market later in the day. But in the past, that generally only occurred two or three times a day. Going forward with this shift in payments, we anticipate that second rounds of dealing will be more frequent. Given this, we intend to formalise the arrangements for these operations, announcing at a set time each day whether further open market operations will be conducted. What we do at the moment is we sort of see how the market's going, and then fairly late in the day, if we feel there's a need, then we do it, but it's not always at the same time every day. And as I said, it only occurs two or three times a year. So what we're going to do going forward is we'll have a set time each day where we'll announce whether further open market operations will be conducted, and if so, on what terms. And it won't necessarily be overnight, which is generally what happens with, whereas at the moment, second round dealing is generally just for overnight. Where there is a need for an operation, it will be important that there is active participation from ADIs. So when we go to do a second round of dealing, it'd be nice if someone's there on the other side to participate. As with our regular open market operations, what we won't be doing is supplying overnight funds to those individual institutions that are short, or absorbing overnight funds from those that are long. So we are not going to replace the cash market with the second round of dealing. We still expect that to occur. This is only to meet what we are able to identify as unexpected payments or flows in the system as, or changes in the system as a whole. So the fundamental principle, which is we're intending to put the appropriate amount of settlements funds in the system as a whole to make sure that the cash rate keeps operating and that the cash market keeps trading at the cash rate target, That's still there. So as I said, in the end, we're probably looking at the cash market staying basically the same size it is at the moment. These second rounds of dealing will be operating to ensure that ES funds are, you know, in the sort of surplus ES funds remain at around $1 billion. So that's what's happening in come November. So as I said, from November, the second rounds of dealing will probably become more frequent. So let me now turn to the liquidity reforms, which are obviously going to be introduced in Australia from beginning of 2015. So as is well known, those ADIs to which APRA applies the Basel III liquidity standard will be required to hold enough high-quality liquid assets, HQLA, to withstand a 30-day period of stress. As is equally well known to all of you, with only CGS and semis meeting the Basel criteria for HQLA in the domestic market, there are not enough of those securities to enable ADIs to meet the standard. So at the present time, ADIs own around $130 billion in total of these securities, of CGS and semis. So a rough estimate, and let me state this is a rough estimate, would be that this is as much as $300 billion short for the system as a whole of what ADIs would need to be able to meet the Basel standard, given the current balance sheet structure. So that's taking the sort of numbers that you guys have been providing to APRA in recent times, looking at what that potentially implies in terms of overall need for HQLA. $130 billion in CGS and semis leaves a shortfall of about $300 billion. Mostly, ADI's holdings are in semis, and these holdings of semis have increased almost tenfold since 2007, now around 40% of the semi-government bond market. Now, our assessment is ADI's holdings of HQLA are broadly appropriate to the current size of the market, and that was the message which went out in the press in the media release that APRA put out last week. So let me just... The press release said that the current holdings are appropriate, and let me stress that's for the system as a whole, not necessarily for every individual institution. Let me clarify one, or provide a bit of colour around that. Should the supply of these securities increase further? So if semis and CGS supply increases further, and that is what's currently projected, we would expect that ADIs would raise their holdings in line with the increased supply. So the share of the market is basically what we're using to assess the adequacy of holdings, not the level. So if the stock goes up, we would expect that ADIs can hold more of that, and probably roughly in proportion. That said, it's not possible or, in fact, desirable to be too precise about what is appropriate. The aim, what we're trying to do here, is ensure that the markets for CGS and semis continue to function well. What we don't want to do is find out the hard way that ADIs are holding too large a share of the market. So compelling ADIs to hold the entire supply of government debt, for instance, would be counterproductive for the liquidity of the market and actually defeat the whole purpose of what you're holding these things for in the first place, which is they're liquid. Notwithstanding that fundamental issue, we actually think it would be difficult to engineer such an outcome. So at some point, if we said that you guys had to hold a lot more of CGS and semis, the scarcity of those securities would cause their yields to fall to a particularly low level. And to some extent, that's already the case with CGS, which generally trade in Australia at an expensive price compared to sovereign debt in other jurisdictions. Nevertheless, if it was the case that the yields on both CGS and semis fell to a particularly low level, that would raise the demand for ES balances. I mean, ES balances are HQLA. So if CGS and semis become too expensive, then everyone would just switch to holding higher ES balances. So while the rate on surplus ES balances, 25 points below the cash rate, generally means that ADIs don't hold them as a store of liquidity, in the absence of a sufficiently attractive alternatives, would be likely the case that ADIs would inevitably use them to comply with the liquidity standard. Now, higher demand for ES balances in and of itself is not a problem. However, it is important, and as I mentioned earlier, in 2008 we ended up increasing the supply of ES balances from about $1 billion up to 18. And it is important, though, that it doesn't interfere with our ability to implement monetary policy. So within the bank's framework, it would be quite problematic if the demand for ES balances varied to allow ADIs to comply with a liquidity standard rather than with changes in their actual cash position. And for that reason, to basically have it be the case that ADIs don't use ES balances as their primary mechanism of complying with the Basel III standard, the Reserve Bank Board in November 2010 approved the introduction of the Committed Liquidity Facility that is consistent with the arrangements for such facilities that is set out within the Basel standard. The facility was announced publicly the following month. The technical details of the CLF were worked out during 2011 in consultation with APRA and were announced publicly at the end of that year, so at the end of 2011. There was then a public consultation period following APRA's announcement of the new liquidity arrangements that ran for 3 months. Put simply, for the payment of a fee, the CLF will commit the Reserve Bank to purchase eligible securities from ADIs under repo. Actually, that looks a lot simpler when you read it than when you speak it, anyway. As the range of securities eligible to be sold to the Reserve Bank is considerably broader than just CGS and semis, it addresses the problem of there being insufficient securities for ADIs to hold that meet the Basel standards. So subject to APRA's approval, an ADI will be able to use the Reserve Bank's commitment under the CLF to bridge the gap between its holdings of CGS and semis and the amount of HQLA required to meet the standard. So through your consultation with APRA, there'll be a total amount of HQLA that you need to be hold. There'll be some amount of CGS and semis. The CLF makes up the difference. When it comes into operation in January 2015, the CLF will work in exactly the same way as the bank's existing liquidity facility. Indeed, the CLF is simply a means by which the Reserve Bank will make a contractual commitment to an ADI to provide funding under its liquidity facility. As is the case in commercial lending contracts more generally, the bank's commitment under the CLF will be contingent on appropriate conditions being met, namely an assessment that the ADI continues to have positive net worth. As I have said, the CLF simply guarantees access to the bank's existing liquidity facility, and ES account holders use that facility every day. At the moment, it is used almost exclusively for intraday funding, as I mentioned earlier, through intraday repos. After November this year, when DE payments are settled for same-day value, it will be used for open repos as well. So what I'm trying to get across here is it's basically exactly the same as what we do currently, it's just potentially on a slightly larger scale. From 2015, ADIs subject to the liquidity standard will only be able to use CGS and semis in the bank liquidity facility unless they have paid the 15 basis point commitment fee for the CLF. So in this way, any ES balances acquired from the bank's liquidity facility will always represent the exchange of one liquid asset for another and cannot improve an ADI's compliance with the liquidity standard. The consequences of this is that small drawings on the CLF will be a routine event as part of normal operations to manage payment flows. Provided the funds are paid same day, or in the case of open repos, are retained in the ADI's ES account, there's no cost to using the facility this way. So what we're talking about coming in from November this year, is effectively a very small operation on a daily basis of the CLF. However, should the funds be used for any other purpose, such that the balance on the account is below where it should be, the penalty be 25 basis points above the cash rate target. So effectively, you know, if you're going overnight, that's effectively, you know, utilising the CLF, you'll get charged the 25 basis points. Such a use of the CLF is likely to occur in more stressed circumstances. As I mentioned earlier, 25 basis points has long been the penalty rate attached to the bank's liquidity facility, designed to discourage ADIs from relying upon the facility for funding purposes during normal times. So in a stress scenario, of course, this penalty rate of 25 basis points may not appear so onerous, but that's by design. In such circumstances, i.e. in stress circumstances, it's appropriate that the central bank provides liquidity support against suitable collateral. This principle of central banking dates back at least to Badgett. Lend against good collateral at a penalty rate, but not a penal rate. The experience here in Australia over many years is that this penalty of 25 basis points has been sufficient to ensure that there has not been excessive use of our liquidity facility. So we actually published the usage of that facility on the website with a small lag, and it's recorded in the bank's annual reports in the chapter on operations and financial markets. So even in 2008 and 2009, the facility was only drawn on a couple of times for very small amounts and for no longer than one day. So a couple of times people went overnight, And in every case, it was to deal with unexpected payment flows, nothing more than that. So to put the rationale for the CLF another way, the purpose of holding liquid assets is to sell them during periods of stress. In the Australian context, this will mean using funds raised via the CLF. This need not be the last resort, that is, after all other avenues have been exhausted. The point of liquidity regulations is to avoid fire sales of non-liquid assets and other actions that might have adverse effects on broader financial stability. So in a very stressed environment, generally, as recent experience has shown, not great if someone has to go out and try and sell all their balance sheet at once in a fire sale. It doesn't tend to have good implications for the system as a whole. Again, that a central bank should be prepared to play this role is nothing new. So in this sense, the fee of 15 basis points that the Reserve Bank will apply to any commitments made under the CLF can be seen as a means of explicitly charging the large ADIs an appropriate price for a liquidity option that they have always implicitly held. So in thinking about the appropriateness of such a fee, it's important to remember that under the CLF, the Reserve Bank will only provide funding against the market value of an eligible security at the time the facility is accessed, not the market value at the time any commitment is established. So furthermore, the bank will haircut the security's market value by as much as 25%, depending on what the collateral is. So taking account of the haircut, the effective cost of obtaining this liquidity can be considerably higher than the 25 basis point penalty combined with the annual 15 basis point commitment fee. So to access a CLF, you've got the 15 basis point annual fee. When you actually need to draw on it, you get charged the 25 basis points, and then the value of the funds will provide against that will be our assessment of the market value of the security on that day with the appropriate haircut. So as I said, if it's not on the day you signed up for the facility, it's on the day that the facility is actually accessed. So consequently, the CLF is only, and not completely, insuring an ADI against the liquidity risk on its securities. The credit and market risks attached to any securities remain with the ADI. So as is the case with all repos contracted by us, should the market value of a security decline while you've got it on repo with us, the bank will require additional securities to be delivered to restore the original value of the repo. Similarly, should the credit quality of a security held by the bank fall below a certain threshold, like the eligibility threshold, the ADI will be required to replace the security with one that meets the eligibility criteria. So deriving the precise value of this liquidity option that we're providing is not straightforward. So certainly, as acknowledged in the Basel standards, it is not appropriate to simply look at the yield differential between government bonds and other securities eligible for the CLF. That spread will largely reflect compensation for credit and other non-liquidity risks, as well as that part of the liquidity risk which the bank is not insuring, which is the bank's haircut. So we only want to charge for the liquidity component of that spread. The credit spread should be retained by the party bearing the ongoing credit risk, which is the ADI, and not us. For example, if we look at this, let me go through a couple of ways you can look at how to come up with the 15 basis points. So if you look at the spread between a three-month bank bill and the expected cash rate, it's around 15 to 18 basis points currently. Before 2007, it was in single digits. Much of that spread is credit risk, which implies the liquidity component is actually reasonably small. So while that spread rose considerably during the crisis, and some of that did indeed reflect an increase in the liquidity premium, much of the increase was a result of heightened credit concerns, evidenced by the rise in CDS premium at the same time. Theoretically, some indication of the cost of hedging liquidity risk can be extracted from the term repo rate on eligible securities that we do every day. So by way of illustration, since adopting our current haircut schedule for repos, we've contracted one-month repos at an average premium of about 4 basis points above cash, while for a six-month repo, the average premium is about 8 basis points over the expected cash rate. The CLF is effectively an option with a strike price set 25 basis points above the cash rate. So we can use those sort of term repos to give us some idea of the likely cost of that providing that liquidity. Haven't done so for a while, provided one-year repo, so it's more difficult to measure that. But anyhow, the six-month ones give us a reasonable guide. Of course, during periods of stress, the cost of liquidity can rise significantly, and it's the potential for this to occur that gives the option actually some value. separate to any market-derived estimates of the appropriate fee, an equally important consideration in pricing the CLF was to maintain consistency with the rest of the bank's operating framework and not compromise our ability to actually implement monetary policy. So as I suggested earlier, it is likely that, at least initially, the bank will be making commitments under the CLF of around $300 billion. We'll have a more precise figure of that more precise indication of that figure after APRA completes the trial liquidity and budgeting exercise that is currently underway. So instead of introducing a CLF and committing to fund assets, the alternative is that we could have opted to purchase the assets ex ante, expanding the supply of ELS balances and the bank's balance sheet by $300 billion. So we could have taken all of it onto our balance sheet from the beginning of 2015. That is, the liquidity provision could be provided for the whole system ex ante rather than provided to an individual institution when required. Effectively, what the CLF does is it requires ADIs to pre-position the securities but retain them on their own balance sheets. The alternative approach would see the Reserve Bank's balance sheet increase by more than three times over from its current size. Such an outcome would not only jeopardise the functioning of the cash market and hence the implementation of domestic monetary policy, but also impair the functioning of domestic securities markets. Moreover, it would not be feasible for the bank to conduct such large-scale asset purchases through its regular open market operations, i.e. going out and buying $300 billion worth of stuff. This would mean a large-scale purchase of domestic securities by the RBA, and we just don't think there's enough large enough pool out there that we could actually that we're willing to hold it on an outright basis. Hence, it would mean a series of bilateral arrangements with ADIs along the lines of open repos that I discussed earlier, with self-securitised assets serving as the collateral. To implement monetary policy in such an environment, given basically they'd be the only assets out there, which would allow us to get our balance sheet up by three times over. To implement monetary policy in such an environment, the price of accessing such arrangement would be needed to be set so as not to create an incentive for ADIs to generate the required ES balances through other means. And basically, if you go through all of that, you end up back at what the CLF is in the first place. The purpose of establishing the CLF was to ensure that ES balances should continue to play their existing role in the bank's operations. This means that ADIs seeking to raise their liquid assets holdings should, at the margin, prefer to use additional CGS semis or an increased subscription to the CLF instead of holding more ES balances. Put that another way, we don't want ES balances to be the margin of adjustment as you guys adjust your liquidity needs throughout the course of the year. Our assessment is that the CLF fee of 15 basis points should allow this to be the case. The pre-positioning of these securities, combined with the enhanced information requirement for asset-backed securities that we announced last year, will allow us to make a more detailed credit assessment of these securities. Consequently, we'll be able to more precisely assess the value of the securities at any point in time and also be able to reduce our reliance, or sorry, our use, we don't rely on them, but our use of rating agencies. So when we get this more granular information, again from the beginning of 2015 through the data warehouses, we'll be able to give much more precise valuation on those securities than we do currently, which benefits us but also benefits you potentially. So let me wrap up by saying over the next 18 months, there are going to be significant developments in the Reserve Bank's balance sheet resulting from the upcoming changes in the payment system and the commencement of the committed liquidity facility. Both of these changes are being accommodated within the general framework for the implementation of monetary policy that has operated successfully in Australia for some considerable time. The payment system changes coming in November will see some increase in the size of our balance sheet, but no material change in either the risk, because we're basically matching with the matching open repos, but no change in the risk or income that we're getting from the balance sheet. The design of the CLF is very much in keeping with the Reserve Bank and, for that matter, other central banks' provision of liquidity to the financial system. It should not result in any material change in the size of the balance sheet. In fact, it's structured very much to avoid a significant increase in the balance sheet. And the main aim of that is, one, to be able to conduct monetary policy in exactly the same way as we've done for many years, and also make sure that the domestic markets, the cash market and beyond, continue to function as effectively as they have today. So I said they're the two main changes. The payment system, one coming in November, increases our balance sheet from about $100 billion to $130 billion, but basically effectively grosses it up on both sides. The CLF, we don't expect to have a material impact on either our balance sheet or on the functioning of the cash market or of other domestic markets. that was probably all reason said that should not have come as any great news to many of you, all of you, I hope. Nevertheless, there's more. All of this is up on the website. We've also, round about now, in the technical notes for domestic market operations on the bank's websites, all of this is now actually up there permanently, so everyone should be able to see it. And if there's any thing that is unclear, hopefully it's made clear by what's ever there. So let me finish there and take any questions. If there's what I'm not going to take questions on is anything that APRA should be answering. And even though they're here, they're not going to answer the question either. If there's any particularly technical questions on the payment systems, Pete's going to answer it. And if it's on market operations, Matt's going to answer it. So I just answer the easy high-level questions. Also, bear in mind that there are media in the room, so don't say anything which is going to cause you any problem from a disclosure point of view. So with that said, happy to take any questions that anyone might have. Yeah.
Kevin Stevenson, AMP Bank. You said the Reserve Bank will set the market value of the security at the time of the repo. In times of severe stress, and there's not really trading in securities, yep. And for instance, an RMBS, difficult to know what is the market value, and we could have a very different thought on market value than your thought, and we could get a nice surprise when it comes time to repo it. Anyway, for us to have an expectation of what your market value is going to be.
So, what our market value won't be will be the fire sale value of the security. From the beginning of 2015, when we've got the data warehouses in place and we're able to look at the detail of the security itself, we'll have our valuation capacity to do our own. We will be doing our own valuation of those securities. You guys will be providing us with updated information on that on a monthly basis, so we'll be able to provide assessment of that valuation on a high frequency basis. So, there shouldn't be
The market value of a security during a stress period like an RMBS will change.
No, that's right. But what I'm saying is our assessment of the value of the security. I may have misspoken. Said it's not going to be the fire sale value of the security. It's going to be our assessment of the fair value of the security based on the information that you guys have provided it to that. It's not going to be orthogonal to the market price. It will still be an import. But I said if there's no obvious pricing point out there, we will have the capacity to be able to assess the value of that. I don't see that there should be large surprises. I suppose the main point to say is it's not going to be the value that it was on the 1st of January 2015 necessarily, mostly because as the market moves, but also because the characteristics of the security itself have potentially evolved since then too. Any other questions? Yeah. Oh, yeah. One here and then there. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you about the reliance. This is a broader question involving the Basel III requirements as well as implemented in Australia, the reliance on government securities, which you're attempting to address with this scheme. It does seem that there's still some potential for fire sales if you've got all of the world's financial institutions sort of herded into holding large amounts of government securities, 40% of the semi-market, for instance.
Well, I think you have to distinguish between idiosyncratic and a systemic event. So if there's a systemic liquidity event going on there, then the central bank's in the business of providing liquidity to the system as a whole. In an idiosyncratic event, where only one institution's in trouble, then that's, depending on the size of that institution, doesn't necessarily need to be a fire sale, right? But if the system as a whole is, that's the situation where you don't want everyone trying to self-liquidate. And that's when the central bank's serving there, providing the system to the liquidity as a whole. So then you have to distinguish. The Basel standard is effectively, Nick can correct me if I get this wrong, even though he doesn't want to say anything, but basically it's designed for an idiosyncratic event, the liquidity standard. It's not a systemic event, is a slightly different situation than that. So in that world, you're not going to have, to put it another way, if the whole of the system is under liquidity stress, then there's not going to be anyone on the other side willing to buy, right? So, you know, you've just taken a whole... If most of the market is on the sell side, there's not probably going to be anyone out there on the other side as the buyer. So in that environment, where there's a systemic liquidity event, as indeed has occurred at various stages over the last few years, then the central bank provides the liquidity to the system as a whole. So another question there.
Thanks. In the Dahlia ES balances, are you still going to be publishing the balance net of the repos so we can sort of see the gauge?
Good question. Yeah. Yes. So we look slightly different from what we publish at the moment. So you'll be able to... Actually, I'll get you to answer. That's right? Yes. I'm pretty sure. We had this conversation yesterday, so I just want to make sure. But yes, we will change what's up there at the moment, so you'll be able to see what is the sort of trading part of the cash market, and what's the, and as well as what is the sum of ES balances, you know, which will be the, you know, so effectively, if one put it this way, you'll be able to see that total ES balances are, say, 31 billion, of which 1 billion is effectively the, for want of a better term, surplus ES balances, or effectively the functioning part of the cash market, if you want to put it that way. And we'll also, report what the trading volume is in the cash market as you guys currently report to us, as well as what rate that trades at, obviously. Any other questions? No. So I should not have, you know, hopefully, as I said, most people should have found, well, beyond understanding what the hell I was saying, but it's the information we basically provided to everyone over the last few months. So, as I said, hopefully it should be reasonably clear. But, so, anything else? Yep, sorry.
The 20 billion increase in your balance sheet.
Yeah.
Do you see that sort of becoming just lazy money that's now just ineffective in the economy? Or because of the operations you described?
No, it's actually very effective because it's settling all the DE payments. So that's it's actually...
You described it comes to no net effect, but I'm just...
It's not a lot. I mean, and so at the moment, you know, open repos, our balance sheet fluctuates plus or minus 15, well, up 15 and then down $15 billion every day, which is achieving exactly the same thing, which is facilitating the payments flow through the economy. So it's actually... relative to some others, you know, it's actually extremely, it's a long way away from lazy, let me put it that way. It's actually allowing institutions to, you know, to settle those payments flows out of ours. So there's actually stuff going on there. So, and then the collateral that the banks are going to be holding to under those open repos, I would say, is not going to be collateral that is going to be doing anything else either. So it's actually putting that lazy collateral, but otherwise lazy collateral, to work to generate these payment flows effectively. Yeah.
In terms of the second round HOMOs, would you envisage a period of them, you said, not necessarily being overnight repos, for terms of, say, a week, and what sort of time and publication of the results, and that we sort of wait 15
You can answer this question. It's a good question. It's actually a good way to get this out to everyone at the same time.
Okay, I mean, probably it'll be a number greater than one, anywhere from 2 to, say, 7
days.
7 days, yes. The precise announcement time we're yet to work out. We'll probably liaise with the AFMA Cash Committee before formalising it, but probably 5:15 or something like that.
And the results will be, you know, it'll be published the same way as we do our morning operations.
Exactly. We'll look at the same on Reuters, and then the results will come out, you know, 15 minutes later or whenever.
All right. Okay. There's no more questions. Thanks all for coming along. As I said, if you've got further questions, we're certainly happy to hear from them. I mean, or as you said, either raise them at the cash committee, or just get directly in touch with Pete if it's on the more on the payment side, or Matt if it's on the cash market side. Okay. Well, thanks very much, everyone. Hope that was at least of some use.